wonderful and horrible. And all Buddhist practice is aimed at perception and observation to gain deeper understanding of that reality of what is happening. When you look deeply and carefully at the chain of cause and effect, you can hopefully, eventually, according to the sutras, see that it is both beginningless and endless. You can never find a start or an end to it. That's why it's called cyclic existence. So, the word God means a lot of things to a lot of people. To me, in this context, for most Americans, it means a first or initial cause. Buddhism does not believe in a first or initial cause. Cyclic existence is beginningless and endless. Next question.
Well, but what's his view on the topic of God?
The Buddha?
Is that what you're asking, Kate?
She typed it. She's here we go.
She's typing? I can't see the screen, so I have no idea.
Okay, I'm here.
Genius.
So my understanding of cyclical existence and cause and effect is well understood, but like, where did everything begin? There's, you know, there had to be a focal point of beginning.
Yeah, so, and that's a... That's, we're going to have to get into a little bit of a weird area. So if we go back and we look at the historic spiritual political climate of Shakyamuni Buddha's day. So what that means is his engagement within the realm of Hinduism. We must understand, we today, and a number of centuries prior to right now, we have had this almost offensive, egoic point of view that Buddha was somehow absolutely not Hindu, which is really a terrible thought. But this is what we like to do, and we like to say that his teachings are so fantastic and unique that he had nothing to do with it. Well, yes, his teachings are absolutely fantastic and unique, but he was very much a part of Hinduism. And he fields this question quite often. Generally, we like to use the statement when, or the story of when he was confronted by a Brahmin, who wants to have him imprisoned. If you don't know, Shakyamuni, like any other great religious teacher, had numerous assassination attempts made on him and all of that. His story was not as glamorous as we like to paint it. He was causing all kinds of turmoil. He was destroying the caste system, which means he was a social renegade. He was also challenging the authority and the religious structure of the priesthood and so forth. So he was not always incredibly well liked. And there were a number of assassination attempts made on his life. In one of those preparing for the attempt, they wanted a reason to arrest him. And so they decided if we could get him to prove that he's a heretic, we got him. And this specific village was, you know, that was their plan. So they directly questioned him. Do you say there is a God? Because Buddha, again, we like to say that he didn't talk about it. That's not true. And I'll touch on that in just a moment. But the Buddha's response was, no. That's it. One word. He said, no. So now, the Brahmin looking around at the other Brahmins going, okay, I think we're going to get him, says, so then you are an atheist and you say there is no God. Is that right? And the Buddha says, no. One word answer. So now the Brahmin's looking at his cohorts going, what the hell, we thought we had him here. Now what's going on? So they ask him again. Do you or do you not believe in a God? Or the gods? And the Buddha says, no. So you don't believe. That's what you're saying? And he says, no. It's not what I'm saying. Well, now they're confused. And they ask him very directly, sir, we don't understand your response. And the Buddha says, I am not giving you a response. I am nullifying your question. I'm saying no on the very basis of what you're trying to ask me. And why is this? Because whether I believe or do not believe in a God has nothing to do with you. Nor anyone else. Because it would only exist through direct immediate experience. And that would be mine and would not need an outer qualifier. So if you're asking me if I believe in one like you believe, I do not. If you're asking me if I believe in one different from yours, I do not. If you're asking me if there is one, there is not. If you're asking me if there is not one, I would say that's not true either. And he refused to answer the question. Now, the Japanese love that, and they run with it. But that's not the rest of the story. Because if we go back and we look at one of the most unquestioned, absolutely authoritative texts from very, very early on. So it's one of those, we have no doubt that this is authentic of all of the early sutras. We have it classified as, and if you want, write this down. It's a very difficult read, but if you want, this is it. The numerical discourses of the Buddha. Basically what they did is they took a whole bunch of teachings that had something to do with a number. In each chapter, they put in whatever he's talking about. You know, well, there's three of these and there's three things of that. And so they put it all together in the chapter of threes. Okay, great. It's an absolutely authentic, no arguing. This is a legitimate stuff. Not like that Mahayana and Vajrayana crap. This is the real thing. Okay? The Buddha says in there, chapter of ones, if I'm not mistaken, the Buddha says, and to do my best to quote it, monks, there is nothing more than this one thing that I know that at the time of death will bring a practitioner to the total state of liberation than this one thing. And what is this one thing? Not forgetting the gods at the time of death. Well, what the hell does that mean? I thought we didn't have a God in Buddhism. I thought we were free from all of that stuff. Well, then how is it that the Buddha would say, at the time of your death, if you can remember, actually, I think it's a chapter of fours or fives, because he gives a list. At the time of your death, if you think on this, or this, or this, or this, and one of them is, if you do not fail to remember the gods at the time of your death, you will attain your liberation. Well, since when does God have anything to do with Dharma? Well, apparently it always has. Because this is very, very early teaching. And he says, if you remember them and their attributes, you're good. Okay. Now we've qualified that the Buddha was all about deities. Here's the problem we run into in the West. So now we've got all these deities, and he talks about them all the time. In fact, if you read other sutras, in the very beginning, they're pointed out. Thus I have heard, at one time, the Buddha is hanging out in Sarvasti. And while he's hanging out there, he's got 35,000 monks and nuns and 70,000 bodhisattvas. And then the sutra is given, and at the very end of the sutra, and it says, and at that time, 30,000 monks and nuns attained their enlightenment, as well as 70,000 bodhisattvas. And all of the gods and demons rejoiced at the teachings of the Buddha that they had heard. So there's no question in the Buddhist mind, not a real one, real Buddhism, followers of Shakyamuni Buddha, there's no doubt that there's deities. There are, in fact, gods, which is why he didn't reject Hinduism. But here's what he did reject. Two, only 2 points. Number one, there's no such thing as a single point creator God. Now, of course, that got him in a lot of trouble. Because all those people that love Brahma or Vishnu are pissed. And he's like, hey, sorry, but it's not true. The second thing is, you're not a fragment of any specific singularity God, meaning you're not a soul that somehow shattered off of it. He rejected that too. Those are the two things that he rejected. Wholeheartedly. Everything else, if you find he's against it, I guarantee you'll find somewhere else where he's all for it. Depending on his audience. Okay? But he does not believe that there is a puppeteer God like general Hinduism teaches, that God wanted to see a reflection of himself, so they blew themselves up and created all of this as a magical display in order to see themselves. Buddha's like, that's a horse shit. That's not true. Didn't happen. Because the divine can't kill themselves that way. It makes no sense. So he's against it. Now, this is important. When he is asked, how did all of this get caused? The Buddha says, while your consciousness was dreaming, you forgot your reality. Thus, you clung to the dream and started misbehaving due to delusion. If you think, well, my dream tells me that I can put my hand in a fire, and you start putting your hand in a fire, you keep burning yourself. But you are under the sway of the belief that you can grab a hot coal out of the fire. And so you spend countless lifetimes trying it. But the Buddha says there is not something that controls fate. He's absolutely against fate. He's against the idea of a god manipulating everything. And he's against the idea of one creating anything. So if you want to go back and say there needs to be a singularity point where everything starts, the Buddha would say, no, that's just Western science being stupid. because there isn't. That's his response. Which means for the rest of us who really want to engage Buddhism the way that Shakyamuni would have engaged it, we're practicing all kinds of deities. Ganesha, Kali, Tara, you name it. They're everywhere. Vajrakalaya. Right? They're, I mean, well, you can't see our space, but we have them everywhere. Because that's what the Buddha did. And then he, of course, goes on to talk about them in much more detail. And then certainly his two of his great bodhisattvas, Manjushri and Vajrapani, go on to give massive amounts of discourses on deities. So hopefully that helps a little bit more clarification that Buddhism is absolutely not a monotheistic belief system, nor is it atheist, nor is it poly. It's only whatever your direct immediate experience of those things are. And so if you say, well, I've never seen it, did you ever try? Because if you haven't tried, then that's fine. That's probably why you haven't. I love that argument. Those people that, you know, they just want to draft up the agnostic, well, I've never heard God. Say, so, well, if you've never tried, then that's probably why you haven't. Or if you half-ass tried, you got a half-assed response, which means you didn't recognize it. But it's always there. Just like nobody ever pays attention that they breathe air. Are you going to say there's no such thing as air? You engage it all the time. Scientists engage it way too much by breaking down every little element of it. And then they forget that it's just air. And get confused by all these gigantic mathematical equations, which isn't true. Air does not exist because of math. Right? The reality is, that's a scientist attempting to explain something that exists. Sometimes we get that backwards. We think that science creates something. That's not right. Science is only trying to explain its existence, how it operates, through their observations. Buddha did the same thing about the divine. Because there's no real, there's nothing, no such thing as Kali. There's only Divine Mother and Divine Father and the union of them. So I hope that helps.
It does.
Yeah, so this is why we don't have to get in too big of a fight with monotheistic groups. The biggest problem is that they will want you to only believe in theirs, and that's slightly problematic. Because we can't really do that in good conscience. Because we can't accept that they know. Even if the guy says, no, I know because I went and saw him, it's like, well, then that's great for you. But I went behind the same curtain and it was some chick. So there was a goddess, not a guy. And she had big antlers. You see? Mm-hmm. You gotta be careful with that stuff. She gave me butter and honey. Had me take off my clothes and dance around a fire. It was awesome. And the other guy goes, you're a pagan. Well, yeah, that's who I saw. Yeah, so you got to be careful with this stuff. Good question, though. I want to say that was chapter of fives, wasn't it?
Man. Towards the end of where we were looking at it, so.
Yeah.
Probably.
But there's my overly long answer.
Next question.
Oh my God, is he going to answer again? He takes two.
I can ask one.
All right.
Well, I'm not able to practice morning as long and often.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
You're coming, cutting in and out, but keep going. You're not able to practice in the morning as often as you would like, or as you used to.
Yeah, right. You feel better, get a lot in the mornings, but now with the apartment, it's a little harder. So I've been trying to think of other ways to incorporate like the. Thinking him towards the Dharma and smaller practices during the day. Or, and then one thing about is do before you go to sleep. It's not a full practice. Being smaller or.
You're wondering if there is something you can do before you go to sleep?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, two things.
That's not full.
Right, right. Well, I'll start with that. You took the Bodhisattva class, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a practice that's given in there. Before you go to sleep, you should reflect on your day. What positive actions were taken, what negative actions were taken. You can also do a confession, or if you have a Vajrasattva, you can say that mantra or think of him or whatever. Really, you know, you could think of Tara too. And this is where you would also vow or aspire to improve your actions the following day. This doesn't need to take very long. And it's very good to envision, you know, your chosen deity or the Buddha or whoever as you fall asleep. You can even say their mantra as you're falling asleep. This should usually help prevent nightmares and things like that. But it's extremely important, no matter who you are, no matter what kind of practice you do, to do something as you're falling asleep. Something like this, something along these lines. I would, if I were you, Jesse, I would go and grab the Training the Mind by Chogyam Trungpa. I forget exactly which slogan it's under, but there's more information there where he talks about it. I think it's, is it Practice the Five Strengths?
I'd have to look at it. I don't remember.
Does anybody remember? All right.
Thought it was the three things.
Oh, well, we have a copyright here, so I guess we're gonna find out. Remember, always remember the three.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Three things that never land. That's the
yeah, I would just not add, but I would make a footnote to one area. Be very, very diligent and very quick to react to the arisal of guilt and poverty mind. Don't let that crap come in. Listen, there's entire practices where they only say one word. That's their whole practice. They don't do offerings. They don't prostrate. They don't take refuge. They don't do anything other than they recite one word. Now, if they recite it 100,000 times a day or three times a day, doesn't matter. That's the practice. They recite one word and reflect. Whatever amount of time that you can put into your practice and you can do it sincerely, then your practice is fulfilled for the day. I mean, obviously, you know, if you go off and do something crazy like, well, I'm going to take a bunch of vows that I have to do these things, well, now you're kind of in trouble because you have vowed to actually do them. But I don't know many people that have that kind of stuff without being in some form of a very serious training. And usually no one has that outside of, you know, working with a specific teacher, which is usually the person that gives it to you. But be very careful that you don't allow negativity to arise. And in fact, Dan's entirely correct. The going to sleep practice, if you're not going to do anything all day, do that. If you think on refuge throughout the day, or you think on something, or maybe you're just, you know, walking down the hall at work and you think, oh yeah, Buddha's great. You're done. Seriously, as long as you can continuously, randomly turn the mind towards the Dharma and just have a pleasant thought, may all beings be happy. I'm waiting for this fracking elevator that won't get here. May all beings never have to wait for elevators. Right? You're done. But the one thing that will destroy your practice more than anything, including non-practice, is the arisal of guilt. That's a sickness and a disease that I abhor personally, and that's my main mission to destroy. I hate it. I hate it for other practitioners because I see it as a cancer. It consumes them inside and out. This isn't permission to break your samayas if you have vows. It's not what this is for. You do your best. And once you've done your best, you reflect at the end of the day, did I really do my best? Yeah, I think I did. Then you can tell guilt to piss off. You won't tolerate that crap. Cook it up and make an offering out of it, because it's garbage. And there's a bunch of crocodile-looking guys that love to eat that crap. They really do. So that's my that's how I would footnote into what Dan's response is, because that's very, very good response. But just make sure that you add this.
All right. I'm going to continue, because I want to address, well, you addressed it, but I'm going to talk about the other part. And yes, confession practice, Westerners need to be careful doing confession practice, because it's very easy to fall into that trap of guilt. The other part, which all of this is very much intertwined, and it got brought up already, is practicing throughout the day. There's far more to do than just a formal sitting. In fact, that's the lowest form of practice in the minds of many people. There was a time when, I'll get personal here, I would feel terrible or guilty if I missed my daily sitting practice. But nowadays, if I don't, it's like, no big deal. Because I make sure to focus on practicing when I'm at work, when I'm in the car, when I'm at the grocery store, when I'm sitting on the couch. You can always practice mindfulness, you can practice Tonglen. Like he said, you can think of the Buddha, you can think of devas, gods, if you want, as we mentioned earlier.
Slogan 17.
Slogan 17 is the one.
Yeah.
Is it your favorite slogan?
Oh, it is, yeah. Actually. And it's about the five strengths. And it falls in the first one. One that's the best slogan in the whole book.
And you don't have to do this, but it's completely plausible and possible, and many people get completely crazy about just practicing not on a mat. You can throw your phone away, you can get a job working in a field or someplace where you're not going to get distracted, and just do the crap out of that. And that is a completely legitimate practice. And to piggyback on what our teacher said, you know, it doesn't matter how many teachings you have. The person who has one teaching and actually does it is 1,000% more advanced than the person who has a lot of teachings but doesn't really actually even practice them. So, even if it's something as simple as breathing, like we read about, Buddha himself says that that's a huge deal and can lead to total liberation. So, that's something to think about. I think we have time for one more question, and then all we have time left for is going to be our dedication. So.
We have time. I would, I guess, be interested in hearing a little bit about transferring the mind to the surface and the mantra. How to make it.
Okay.
I didn't hear.
Sure. She's asking about the transforming the mind worksheet.
Yeah.
She doesn't know what it is, and she wants to know what it is. So, to begin with, the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, is a six-syllable mantra, and that is the mantra of Avalokitesvara Bodhisattva. His Tibetan name is Shinrezig, if you've heard that name before, too.
Kuan Yin.
Or Kuan Yin, in China.
Yeah.
Or really just... I mean, he is all bodhisattvas.
Yeah.
All bodhisattvas are the essence of Avalokitesvara. So there's an important word, bodhisattva. As the Buddha continued to teach, his second turning, we call the Mahayana. And that place... Or Bodhisattvayana.
Tom's trying to get us to try do the same thing.
Yeah. So, the emphasis within this vehicle, or this path, is helping others. So, we generally refer to a bodhisattva as one who wishes to awaken themselves, to become awake, so that their awokeness will be the benefit of all others, not just for themselves. And so that path is entirely dependent upon what are called the six paramitas, or six perfections. They are generosity, diligence, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom.
Yeah. If you can wait just a couple seconds, just getting distorted.
I guess it was breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, it really breaks up for like 3 minutes in a row, twice during service. It just happened to do it.
Oh. Is it so it's still doing it?
No, it's better.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, don't worry about that list. The point is, this Transforming the Mind worksheet is all about the actualization of that path. the actualization of realizing Buddha nature in order to be of great benefit to others. And Avalokitesvara Bodhisattva is really the culmination or the representation of the supreme, most perfected example of that. And so we use his mantra in conjunction with this as sort of a reminder and an inspiration. And it contains a lot of power and blessing, the mantra does. So... Sorry?
The mantra sort of invoking him?
Invokes the qualities.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. Invokes his qualities. You know, you could say that... if I were to go out on the street right now and give a sandwich to a homeless person or give somebody a hug, Avalokitesvara is present right there, in a sense. Because those are the qualities of generosity and openness. We want to invoke those qualities and make them present and nourish them to be beneficial to others.
Yeah, the idea is that each one of those slogans in the transforming the mind, all of those put together would be the psychological profile of Avalokitesvara. And what we're wanting to do, because he is the epitome of the householder, he's householder perfected. And of course Shakyamuni calls him the greatest, most compassionate. So the concept is we want to emulate or become eventually exactly like that. That's kind of what we're aspiring to be, which is completely possible. So the idea is that when you say a mantra, the vibration of the mantra, you know, getting all metaphysical, it creates all of this stuff, opens the brain waves and blah, blah, blah. But the idea is that it allows you to become susceptible to the inner meaning or the underlying principle of the slogan in order to infuse it. So if you say, Om Mani Padme Hum, and then you think about one of these slogans, and as you're contemplating, yeah, what is that? What's the real deep meaning of this slogan? And while you're thinking that, you're just doing Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. You're aligning your consciousness with the consciousness of Avalokitesvara. And this is how we transform the mind from our normal, delusional, mundane system that's based on our little god idol, which the Greeks call ego, but we don't use that term because it's not exactly correct. And we're trying to align that more to our actual true nature, which is represented in by the compassionate activity of Avalokitesvara. So this is how we use it. But yes, the mantra is very, very powerful. It does invoke the qualities, that we're discussing in these individual attributes. We're not really going after Avalokitesvara. We're not saying, oh, he's the great saint that I'm trying to... It's the actual quality. Because once you harness them, you'll recognize that you're not actually any different than Avalokitesvara. You guys have the exact same mind. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Good.
All right, well, we are out of time. Hopefully that was beneficial for
Sot songs usually are very useful.